This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 11th of August 2015 on Monocle 24. Section D on Monocle 24 in association with Squarespace. Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. It's going to be me, David Pleasant, bringing you the programme today. In this episode of the show, we'll be finding out why a rather recent architectural gem in London has been given the highest level of heritage protection.
The British Library really is one of the most important public buildings in England in the late 20th century.
Then we'll be taking a private tour around the home of world-renowned South African photographer Gillian Edelstein.
Probably the best present I ever got was this beautiful Rolleiflex that we'd been eyeing out at a local pharmacy. And I used it for a lot of my work in the beginning.
Plus, on news that Washington DC has chosen the Neutra Front for all its communication, we debate if it was the right choice with one experienced designer. All that to come and plenty more besides, right here on Section D on Monocle 24. First up on the show, we look to a controversial building just up the road from Midori House, the British Library. The term heritage tends to be associated with oldness, and a particular type of oldness at that. Fusty, antiquated, bestowed upon relics rather than used objects. But Historic England, the body responsible for identifying English buildings to be protected by listing, interpret heritage differently. The organisation has taken a bold approach to its task, having this year marked for protection over a dozen post-war office and commercial buildings, mainly made of steel, glass and concrete. And this week saw Grade 1 listing of the British Library, a bold red brick structure that only opened in 1998, along with the listing of several other post-war libraries at Grade 2. We sent Monocle's Henry Rees Sheridan to investigate. He spoke to Emily G, Head of Designation at Historic England, about the organisation's approach, but not before heading down to the British Library to check out the building for himself and hear what its users thought.
The British Library's new Grade 1 listing not only recognises the building's special architectural and historical significance, it also protects it from harmful modification and destruction. I've come down to the Piazza of the Library to ask some library users what they think of the building and of its new heritage status.
My first thought when I came here was that it looks like an Asian temple, because I feel like the roof and things, it has some Asian characteristics. So that was kind of interesting. I mean, I like that it's a brick building. It kind of fits with St. Pancras.
I think it's a splendid building. It's a wonderful advertisement, not only for the city, but also for the country. I'm here today with my two grandchildren, and it's given me great delight to just let them walk inside and have a feel for just a fantastic library like this.
I think it's like what it stands for as well, not just as a kind of piece of architecture, which is lovely, but also it kind of holds so many of the books that we deem important to our culture as well. And so I think it is really important that it's protected.
I think it's a really cool building. It looks quite big and looks quite modern.
Well, that's what at least some members of the public think. Now it's time for some expert opinion. I'm heading off to speak to Emily G, Historic England's Head of Designation, about the library and also about the organisation's listing process more generally.
Well, the British Library, as many people know, has a very protracted construction history. It was initially thought to be expanding the site of the reading room in the British Museum, and there were initially plans in Bloomsbury for its construction. It went on for a long time, different thoughts about where it should be most sensibly. And Colin St. John Wilson started to become involved with the building in the late 1960s. And it took about 30 years to be constructed. And he and his main architectural partner, MJ Long, had a lovely quote from MJ recently saying that she and her husband had spent 59 years of their lives together on the building. And what was unusual was that the architects were involved from the very beginning, the conceptualization of the brief And through its construction, through construction drawings, through the design of the building in every detail, from an engineering perspective all the way down to the furniture, the door handles even. So it's a completely sort of, you know, comprehensively designed building. It took a very long time, and for that it was very controversial, but I think now it's been accepted as a much-loved public building in this country.
Maybe you can go into a little bit more detail about the building's assets and tell us why Historic England decided to list the building as Grade 1.
Well, I think it really is one of the most important public buildings in England in the late 20th century. It is a very stately design. It has a real sort of monumental quality. It is very impressive. It holds its own very strongly in that position in a parade of Grade 1 buildings, actually, next to the major railway terminuses. So it's a very grand building, it's very monumental, but it's also very accessible. And I think people feel drawn into it. It's partly the way it's set back very carefully from the horrible Euston Road with this very elegant piazza that sort of draws people in through the portico, across the piazza, which has integrated art. And that's one of the important features of the building. The art was always part of the concept to include interesting pieces of art within the design of the building. And it draws you in through those long, wide steps up to the entrance. It also has a sort of grand monumentality with the great clock tower, which obviously is a reference back to Dudok, and the grand sweeping low roofs with that very warm red brick, which again show the influence of Wilson's great hero, Alvar Aalto. But it also is very contextual. It's very clearly referencing, in my view, the St. Pancras station and hotel next door with its warm red brick, very much in the Gothic Revival tradition. And this building, while being sort of resolutely modern, is also very referencing of that with the warmth of the brick in a very similar kind of colour tone. And in that sense, it is very much in the sort of English sort of free school tradition. And there's multiple architectural references make it very successful and very thoughtful building.
One reason that the listing is so notable is because the building is so modern. As we've mentioned, the design and construction was fairly protracted over about 30 years, but it was actually only open to the public in 1998. Mm. Now, people normally equate heritage and heritage listings with very old, grand buildings, cathedrals and the like, but Historic England has listed several more modern buildings recently. I was wondering if you could say a bit about the general approach to listing that has enabled this by Historic England, and maybe tell us a bit about some of the other modern buildings that you've listed recently.
Historic England advises the government, the Department for Culture, Media and Sport, on what buildings should be listed. And we look at anything which is over 30 years old. And we take as that date the start point of construction. So for this building, we treat it as 1982, which is when the ground is first broken. That's the date we use for start date, because this is a great example of how a protracted length of design and construction means that, you know, it'd be very hard to know what date to choose otherwise. So we're very clear about always using the first date of the ground breaking. And we have a rolling programme, really, of looking at modern buildings for designation. We think it's very important that the very best of the modern is protected. Buildings often fall out of fashion around that sort of 30-year period. So it's important that we're able to recognise and recommend to government the very best of modern architecture to be protected and included on the National Heritage List. There are over 700 buildings of the post-war period that are listed in this country. And that's quite extraordinary. I think that's higher than any number in the world. And 30 years is a fairly recent cutoff date as well. Other countries have a much older date. The United States uses 50 years, for example. So we're very alive to the importance of modern architecture and the importance to protecting it where it matters. But we are very selective as well. So we have to make sure that a building very clearly meets the tests of special architectural and historic interest in order to be included on the National Heritage List. We do also consider buildings that are less than 30 years old in exceptional circumstances. That is, if they are under major threat, and if they are of outstanding interest, which we mean to equate to the higher grades of listing, which is Grade 2 star and Grade 1, which accounts for about 10% of buildings which are listed. And recently, you might be aware of the listing of the former Western Daily News building in Plymouth, which was a design by Nicholas Grimshaw and partners. And it dates from the early 1990s, from 91 to 93. And that was listed recently at Grade 2 star. And it was very much under threat when it first came to our attention. Happily, it's not now. It's been bought by new owners who want to continue the building in its current form. It's a real sort of high-tech splendor. It sort of takes the shape of a ship. It's a really dramatic building by Grimshaw. It's very much in the high-tech tradition, which is so important to where Britain really led the way. And I think it's important that we recognize high-tech architecture along with other styles and traditions. And the Lloyds building is another example of that. So Lloyds and the British Library are both our newest Grade 1 buildings on the National Heritage List, both dating from the early 1980s.
That was Monocle's Henry Rees-Sheridan in conversation with Emily G, Head of Designation at Historic England, on the subject of the British Library. You're listening to Section D with me, David Pleasant. Now, as holiday season in the Northern Hemisphere is in full swing, the team at Section D thought we would give our listeners some summary suggestions on what to pack for your much-deserved seasonal travels. Inspired by some of the very personal favourites of our very Parisienne fashion editor, Daphne Hazard, as well as some of the classics from Monocle magazine's edit section, our A to Z of items might be inspiration to those who are packing for that trip, whether it's to San Sebastian or Santorini.
A is for a very seafaring woman's wear brand, Atlantique Ascoli, founded by Parisian former songwriter and musician by the same name. The summer collection of cotton blouses is as simple as it is seaside chic. Oceanic blues and blinding whites dominate the palette and make a stark but elegant coastal selection.
B is for a pair of Bal Paget for APC. These delicately rustic numbers define excellence in the art of the espadrille and are a nice little Franco-Spanish collaboration too. The hand-woven pita fibre used is light yet strong, perfect for your evening passeggiata or passage to the beach.
C is for Church's sandals, for him or her. The pride of England's shoe capital, Nottingham, might not immediately spring to mind as the quintessential beach fellow, but the Kelsey sandals' classic shape, structured from delicate but sturdy straps of the finest calf leather, make them a summertime must.
D is Daylong, our favourite from that most essential of holiday products, the sunscreen. Be sure to pack a tube or two of the high-performance Swiss-made cream. Daylong's vast range, catered to dozens of skin types, makes it stand out, which should ensure that it's not your sunburned red face that stands out at the restaurant.
E is from Diehez Bikinis, from this, the queen of swimwear labels. Current collections denote ancient Greece with contrasting dark or tone-to-tone hues. While on the subject of bikinis, why not pack several? From Erez in France, go transatlantic with the swimwear collection from New York fashion designer Lisa Marie Fernandez. Much of the collection takes its cues from the bold, color-blocked suits of the 80s, but the look is totally modern. Finally, for him, Bantu Wax's vibrant, heavily patterned swimming shorts are a must. All of the products don't just look African, but are made in that great continent too.
L is for Luniform bags. Of course, the suitcase is as important as its contents, and with these robustly elegant canvas bags used by the French army, your vacation essentials will be safely transported, and you will be sure to look good in transit.
M is for a Maison Michel hat. If you want to cover your head this summer, there are no finer chapeaux than the Parisian headwear and accessories brand. The current summer collection comes to us courtesy of Karl Lagerfeld, so black and white is the order of the day. You might also like to go for a classic Maison Michel fedora for your seashore soirees. W is for wheels, and not the motorised variety. The ones that are pulled or pushed, carry-on or wheelie. The debate rolls or drags itself out every holiday season. For the wheel-free transportation option, long-time Monocle favourite Porter from Tokyo stands the test of time. A three-way Porter duffel with attaching handles, a rucksack strap, and a removable shoulder strap can be changed into a backpack or a bigger bag, perfect for summer escapades that you might choose to extend. If wheels are your thing, or if crushable items demand solidity in a bag, Germany's Remova suitcases are a must. The aluminium or polycarbonate collections have become reliable staples of travel and are inspired by aviation pioneers of the 1920s. If you're not the kind of person who travels light and you want to protect your prized Panama, a Remova king-size Salsa Deluxe 3-suiter should do the trick.
Y is for a Yamabahari beach towel. This high-end Bulgarian brand launched in April this year in time for the summer season on the Black Sea and beyond. A wonderfully esoteric palette of inspiration. Their lines are inspired by trips to destinations as diverse as Iceland and Zanzibar. Yamabahari's towels are in a lightweight cotton to soak up excess wetness but don't become heavy and damp. Talking of towels, another brand to keep you dry is Foresta G, from the Sardinian village of San Pantaleo. The towel collections are double-lined with sponge or honeycomb and feature prints with maps, fish, or a kaleidoscope of symbolic charms. Perfect for lake, pool, or beach.
Finally, Z is for Hermenegildo Zegna sunglasses. Titanium, wood or horn frames come in an incredible range of sizes to match all face shapes, meaning that picking a pair that is just right for you is a little easier. The Zegna Men's Bronze Havana Titanium and Acetate front with circular lenses will keep out the glare and add instant med charm to any outfit.
That was Section D's very own summer suitcase suggestions, which have hopefully put you in good stead for a beautifully equipped summer holiday. Coming up on the show, we discuss whether the iconic American font Neutra is more suited to a burger joint or the national capital, as Washington DC makes a bold typographic statement. Plus, we'll be going on an intimate home visit as Monocle's Georgina Godwin is at home with famous South African photographer Gillian Edelstein.
Great design tells stories, and Squarespace's innovative website building tool is the perfect platform from which to tell them beautifully. Showcase your creativity, ideas, and business in style with Squarespace's unrivaled range of online products and services. To see how it could work for you and for a 10% discount, head to squarespace.com and enter the promotion code Monocle. Squarespace. Build it beautiful.
You're listening to Section D with me, David Pleasant. Now we turn our attention to Washington, D.C. and to the city's decision to adopt a standardised single font that will be used, in the words of the city's communications director, for everything from advertising a summer camp to providing information on a public health test. The font chosen is an interesting one, but perhaps not a surprise. The Neutra font, which is more than 70 years old, has been called both vintage and retro. In the words of the DC spokesperson, it has a comforting authority to it. But is this font really suitable for such an important monumental city? Earlier, I spoke to veteran designer at New York studio Pentagram, Paula Scher, who 5 years ago employed the Neutra font for a radically different client to Washington, DC, the then small-scale fast food joint Shake Shack. The chain is now a national giant and displays the Neutra font on just about all its material. To find out more, I questioned Paula on the line from her Connecticut retreat.
It's an older font developed in a period of time that was sort of a form of mid-century modernism. It has a very streamlined feel, very pointy cap initials. I would call it very designy in a way.
You mentioned that mid-century modern heritage of it, and it has in fact been described as a vintage font. Do you think that's a negative or a positive? I mean, that does have its strengths and weaknesses, I imagine.
The typography is indicative of its time. I mean, that it things look a specific way because there was a fashion to it. For example, if you look at slab serif fonts, they were the sort of signage that was used by the British Empire when they were building things like the Suez Canal, and so that they have names like Memphis or like Stymie, and they're named after cities or things in the Middle East. And when you start to look at why things look a certain way, you find that they were just popularized at a specific period of time.
And now, Paula, if we look back some 5 years ago to when you started using Neutra for Shake Shack, tell us how that started.
I work on a little park called Madison Square Park. And in Madison Square Park, Danny Meyer, he had the idea of putting a temporary structure in the park that would be this place called Shake Shack, where he would sell burgers and hot dogs. And because I worked on the park, we were put together. And he had purchased a design by James Wines, a really spectacular architect who specializes in making populist designs for places like department stores or fast food chains that really push design barriers. He's quite amazing. And he designed a structure that was dropped into the park, and they started this hamburger stand called Shake Shack. And so I designed the graphics for it and the identity for it. This first one-off stand, the word Shake Shack was designed for the architecture. The architecture was very streamlined. It had very strong linear component to it. As a matter of fact, there were these two linear stainless bands that ran across, and I put the neutra, the things that says hamburgers, shakes, fries, all of that becomes repetitive in every single Shake Shack. I put that typography in between the band. It was actually part of my idea of how this thing should work as an homage to the past in one framework, and then also something that was wholly new.
And if we jump forward, it's interesting to see that link with architecture. And I can think of no more architectural or monumental city or place than DC. When you found out that Neutra was chosen to represent the city in text form, what was your reaction?
Well, I wouldn't have picked it. I thought it was a funny choice, to be honest. The way I found out about it was somebody ran an article that says Washington, D.C. has the same font as Shake Shack, and that's sort of funny.
Why wouldn't you have picked it? That's interesting.
Well, I look at typography a little bit differently as a designer. You know, that you make selections of typefaces for specific uses for varieties of reasons. And to a degree, you can't anticipate what's going to happen to it 10 years down the road. For example, Shake Shack initially was a one-off stand, and there were four. Now it's global. But what happened to the typeface Neutra as a result of it is people don't know that it was selected because of the architecture. They see it, I suspect, as really a millennial font, something that's connected to this experience of upscale fast food with healthier food and something that's sort of the more contemporary version of what McDonald's was in its day. Here it's got really high quality meat. You pay a few dollars more. The design is nicer. You feel less insulted by the experience. And there are a lot of other fast food restaurants that are now being either established or operate on the same principles as Shake Shack. So the font gets associated with the product, not really with the fact of the period it was designed by Neutra or how it works with architecture. All that becomes forgotten about. I assume for the designer that worked with Neutra in Washington, I don't know who that was for them, they probably thought it was an attractive font.
That was Paula Scher, American graphic designer and principal at New York design studio Pentagram, speaking to me on the typographic travails of the Neutra font. You're listening to Section D with me, David Pleasant. Now, to end the show, we're going to introduce the first of a new feature. Nothing quite personifies our character and spirit as much as our homes. What design choices have we made? What strange little knickknacks do we refuse to chuck away? What do we choose to hang on the wall? And what would we rather hide under the stairs? In this first taste of new Section D item At Home With, Monocle's Georgina Godwin paid a visit to the Hampstead home of world-renowned South African photographer Gillian Edelstein. Georgina began her tour in Gillian's kitchen.
I'm in the kitchen of Gillian Edelstein, who is a photographer, and she's chopping onions very well, actually, I have to say, Gillian, not crying at all.
Deftly is the answer. Assertively.
And we're having a cup of tea here. And having a look around your beautiful, beautiful home. Now, Gillian is a photographer originally from South Africa, and there is much in this room that reminds one of Gillian's roots. So, for instance, I'm standing here under a picture of Nelson Mandela. Now, you've actually photographed Mandela, and I know you just want to get this in the oven, and then we can go and talk about it. Let's move to the other room, and we can take our tea. You left South Africa back in
quite a long time ago, I'd say, in the mid-80s.
And the Mandela Project, that came about through the New York magazine.
It was a project I was working on to do with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, and the New York Times magazine, as part of it, requested me to do the front cover photograph of him. And it was just after he was released, and I photographed him at the presidential house. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission was to do with the end of apartheid, where people would come forward and ask for amnesty for these heinous, terrible crimes that they'd committed. And so there were a form of kind of kangaroo courts hearings all over the country. And I went the length and breadth of South Africa. And the Mandela image was for a cover of the New York Times magazine, as they were the only publication that commissioned me
as part of a whole book project that I was getting together.
Now, Gillian, I know that obviously you work on the very latest equipment. You have many digital cameras and things like that. But looking here, this is a very old Rolleiflex.
That's right. It's probably the best present, actually, besides the birth of my son, the best present I ever got. I was assisting a fashion photographer right at the beginning of my career in Cape Town. And at the end of my employment there, he arrived with a big shoebox. And in the shoebox was this beautiful Rolleiflex that we'd been eyeing out at a local pharmacy. And I used it for a lot of my work in the beginning.
So many people that I recognise here. There's Kristen Scott Thomas over there. There's Helena Bonham Carter and various others. Colin Firth, I know you've photographed. But also a lot of ordinary people from all over the world. Here's one that isn't ordinary, of course. He's Desmond Tutu, Bishop Desmond Tutu. And let's have a look. He's actually written on this photograph. This is one you took of him. And it says, God bless you. It's signed Desmond Tutu. He looks, I have to say, utterly exhausted. He has his hands on his hands on the desk, his head on his hands. This is a man deeply tired.
And that's the reason I took it. I mean, there was a massive debate the night before I was photographing him, and some television journalists talked about we discussed the most powerful images of this Truth and Reconciliation Commission process. And one of them was when Tutu wept into his hands. And I asked him if he would mind recreating that. And he said, I'm so tired. So you hit the nail on the head. He said, I'm so tired that I will happily do this for you. And he shoved his head in his hands. And that was on a large format 4x5 camera. It's one of my special images, I think, of that time.
And then there's this, which I would guess is from North Africa.
She's a fertility wooden sculpture. And I mean, the meaning of this fertility doll was that obviously you would procreate furiously if you were having any problems. And that was, again, something that somebody, I was given that, and we called her Mvanwi. I've no idea whether that has any meaning on anything at all, but I do know that five people in the house and the house adjoining got pregnant soon after she arrived, including me.
You know what? I think we're going to move away from her very, very swiftly. There are some risks that one just doesn't want to take. Now, back into your kitchen, and of course we can hear the oven on and wonderful smells coming through. And just Sam Taylor Wood, or Sam Taylor Johnson, as she is now. She's a director. I think she directed 50 Shades of Grey, actually. I'm sure that's not the thing that she particularly wants to be known for. What brought you to photograph her?
I was commissioned to be part of an exhibition at the National Portrait Gallery called Managing Partners. And she was then married to Jay Jopling, her dealer. And
her art dealer.
Her art dealer. Yes, not her dealer, her art dealer. And this was a photograph, which I got lucky about that, because I think she was rather embarrassed because Jay Jopling ordered me to photograph it in this spot. And then she came in and said, what do you want me to do? And I said, I have this idea of you being in a fetal position on his lap. And she just amazingly threw off her bra, threw off her T-shirt, and had suddenly revealed these amazingly phenomenal pair of knickers and slew herself across his lap. And that was the photograph that I love and that was used in the exhibition.
And let's just go out here. Oh, lovely, lovely evening, light and all the rest of it. Now, just before I leave you, I know that this garden is actually the place where you take many of your photographs.
I do. I've photographed lots of wonderful people, and if I had to name drop, I could. Carl Lucio has been down that alleyway. The best was when he came here for a barbecue and offered to help my father do such a thing, and my father didn't know who he was and promptly dismissed him. Simon Pegg, Rebecca Hall, Rufus Sewell, Ray Fiennes.
All been in this beautiful garden with this in this lovely evening night. Now, Gillian Edelstein, thank you very much for letting me into your beautiful home.
That was Monocle's Georgina Godwin taking a tour of the London home of photographer Gillian Edelstein in the first instalment of Section D's new regular feature, At Home With. And that's all we have time for on this episode of Section D with me, David Pleasant. We'll be back at the same time next week, and if you've missed any of this week's show or for our back catalogue, you can head to monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes to listen again. The show was put together by Alex Funnell. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact me, David Pleasant, at dmp@monocle.com. As always, thanks for listening and goodbye.